Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, is brought to you by the members of the John Adams. Why not become a member yourself, or even better, a patron, and enjoy all the extras and benefits? Find out more at john-adams.nl, john-adams.nl, and click on Become a Member. From Amsterdam, this is Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute, a treasure trove of the best and the brightest of American thinking. And if you ask author George Packer if America is a failed state, his answer is maybe.
When equality disappears, when the belief that you can be as good as everyone else disappears, there's no longer any basis for citizenship, for a shared idea of Americanness, because it doesn't come from blood and soil and tradition. And then self-government is lost. And I think something like that is what's happened in the last 40 or 50 years.
This is an election year, and in his book, The Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal, George Packer makes the case for why this may be the most important election since the Civil War. Packer accepts that America may be a failed state, a state that is in a cold civil war between four incompatible versions of the U.S., the free America of libertarian Reagan, the smart America of Clinton-era technocrats, the, quote, real America, end quote, of the bottom-feeding demagogue Donald Trump, and the just America of hashtag MeToo and BLM. Packer says this cold civil war has made Americans profoundly unreal to one another. They lack a shared reality, have burrowed into partisan encampments, or sealed themselves in digital echo chambers of angry prejudice. But as Mr. Packer told our Amsterdam audience back in April of 2022, it isn't all bad news. After all, America has had many such crises and has recovered from them all. And he offers a solution: the creation of a fifth version of the U.S., the Equal America, which involves extending the New Deal to Americans in more areas of their lives, from affordable and universal health care to a living minimum wage and beyond. The evening was moderated by the British-American entrepreneur and author Andrew Keane, but first George Packer spoke to the audience with the message, "No one is going to save us. We are our last best hope."
Let's talk about America and whether there's hope. But let's go back, because we can't just start proposing fixes to things we haven't analyzed and don't understand and haven't identified. So let's go back all the way to 1838. Abraham Lincoln, then a very young 28-year-old state legislator, gave a speech in Springfield, Illinois, on the perpetuation of our institutions. And in it, he asked how those institutions of democracy might die. And he said that there would be no Napoleon crossing the Atlantic to go across the Blue Ridge Mountains and drink from the Ohio River. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we must live through all time or die by suicide. Lincoln identified what was going to come in 20 years. We would come very close to dying by suicide. We would not be conquered. We would not become the victim of some external power. We would die by our own hand. To me, that is a very important and relevant thought that we have to keep in our heads. Democracy could die in the United States. There's nothing inevitable about it. In fact, there's something miraculous about its duration, because it is such a fragile system. So how do we think about how American democracy could commit suicide? One way is simply by loss of faith. Public just begins to lose faith in self-government, in our institutions, in our elections, in our leaders, and in the fine statements of the founders. Because it really is only the idea of democracy that holds the country together. Not blood and soil, not even the Constitution or the laws, not our well-known material pursuits. So Walt Whitman, after the Civil War, wrote, "The true nationality of the states, the genuine union, when we come to a moral crisis, is the fervid and tremendous idea, melting everything else with resistless heat and solving all lesser and definite distinctions in vast, indefinite, spiritual, emotional power." Only Whitman could describe democracy that way. But I love that description, the fervid and tremendous idea. Right now, its temperature feels very low. And if it is an idea that holds us together, then our continuation as a democracy is quite endangered, because ideas die. Ideas lose their hold on people. Another way to commit suicide would be to have a civil war, which we had once. And I remember in the run-up to the 2020 election, I don't know how many of you were actually in the United States in those weeks, a lot of people were actually asking, do you think there's going to be a civil war after the election? It was not a crazy conspiratorial question that came out of the dark web. It was what normal people were asking their friends and neighbors. My answer was, I don't think we'll have blue and gray troops lined up, but I think there could very likely be violence, and there could actually be violence on a scale that we haven't seen since the Civil War. I was quite worried. There was so much violent rhetoric and violent feeling, not just because of the hatred between the two parties, but because COVID had left people so frazzled and so out of control. Downtown Washington was boarded up before the election. Shopkeepers fled the city. Soho in New York, the same. Plywood over shops. Obviously, there had been demonstrations over the summer that had led to violence and to broken windows. And there was not just a fear that Trump might unleash his pitchfork brigades, but that the left, if things went against the Democrats, might decide that they had the right to start breaking windows again. So a lot of tension in the air. And then came a miracle. 155 million Americans voted, the largest number by far in any election in our history, in the middle of a pandemic. And there was no violence at all. And in fact, sorry, ex-President Trump, it was the cleanest, fairest, best-run election in my lifetime. So somehow the faith in democracy, the fervid and tremendous idea, got us through that really perilous election. But the violence came 2 months later. And as you all know, January 6th was the closest we've come to the overthrow of the government since Fort Sumter. And it still hangs over our heads. Liberal democracy still hangs in the balance. And the reason is because one party will not reckon with what happened on January 6th and will not face its own role and will not do what it has to make itself clean and healthy and sane again in order to be able to carry on our democracy if power goes to that party. So we're still in jeopardy, and 2024 to me could easily be January 6th times 10. But that insurrection was so shocking that it clarified things. It made me realize there are three red lines in democracy that you can't cross. You can say a lot. You can think a lot. You can have horrible policy ideas. You can have horrible debates over horrible policy ideas. You're still functioning as a democracy. But those three lines are: one, no allowance for hatred between groups, for inspiring hatred between groups, for inciting that kind of dangerous and possibly violent intolerance. Two, you have to play by the rules. You have to accept an election defeat if you're defeated and allow for the peaceful transition of power. You have to accept that the nonpartisans who count the votes are counting the votes correctly, even if it goes against you. You have to play by the rules. And three, you have to have some grasp of the truth. The truth is not entirely fungible and a matter of personal flavor and partisan choice. If I say that there's a wooden podium in front of me, you can't say, you're just saying that because you're a member of the liberal media. So there has to be some solidity that we all stand on in order to then begin to argue about ideas. Without a common ground of shared reality, some sense of shared truth, there's no way you can have the debate that democracies depend on about ideas. All three of those were violated in the worst way by Trump and by his party, and continue to be going forward, because I'm sure you're familiar with all the laws and all the maneuvers that are going on right now in order to make sure that the resistance to Trump's effort to steal the election last time at the level of county boards and election offices and state commissioners and judges, that doesn't get in his way again. So we're actually drifting even closer to the edge. So I've mentioned a few things, and I could mention more, that I think are symptoms of this suicidal tendency that's going on in America. Trump is one. I think of Twitter as a suicidal symptom. I think of wokeness as a suicidal symptom. And we can talk about all of those as we go on. But what I really want to do now is look to the causes beneath these symptoms that are older and deeper. How did we become two countries in perpetual conflict that's become so intense that it does seem like it might lead to widespread violence? So let's go back to Tocqueville. In the 1830s, the great French writer who toured America and wrote what's still the very best book about American democracy, he noticed that the most striking thing about Americans was what he called equality of conditions. He didn't mean everyone lives at the exact same level. It wasn't leveling. He meant equality of social conditions, equality of possibility, that everyone, not that they all lived in that way, but that they all wanted to be as good as everyone else, to be everyone else's equal, to have no obstacles based on birth, or on location, or your family, or your name, that there should be no limit to what anyone can be, and that itself is a kind of almost a spiritual concept of equality. A philosopher named Elizabeth Anderson calls it democratic equality. It's not simply equality of economic conditions. It's an equality of opportunity, of rights, and of citizenship. And I think of it as like the hidden code. It's the hidden code in America. It's the thing that all Americans feel and want, even though there's never been a time when we've all had it. But there may be countries in which whole groups of people can be permanently subordinated and accept that without any civil conflict. That can't happen in America because of that passion for equality that Tocqueville noted. But he feared equality as well because, he said, it leads to individualism. He wrote, aristocracy links everybody from peasant to king in one long chain. Democracy breaks the chain and frees each link. So democracy separates us from each other. We're all at each other's level. There's no relation between us. We're all pursuing our own interests, passions, and fortunes. And that can lead to this extreme inequality that's quite well known in America and that comes from individualism. In other words, equality can produce inequality. So what's the answer to that? Well, Tocqueville had an answer, and his answer was what he called the art of self-government. What did he mean by the art of self-government? And why is it an art? Because it's not natural. people aren't born knowing how to govern themselves. You have to learn it, and it's very hard. You have to acquire skills, what Tocqueville called habits of the heart, the ability to listen and argue and debate and solve problems together. He thought face-to-face, which is why the town meetings were so important for Tocqueville. So equality and self-government, they're in this perpetual relation in America. They're essential to each other. And when equality disappears, when the belief that you can be as good as everyone else disappears, there's no longer any basis for citizenship, for a shared idea of Americanness, because it doesn't come from blood and soil and tradition. And then self-government is lost. And I think something like that is what's happened in the last 40 or 50 years. Inequality has become so deep that it has eroded our ability to govern ourselves, and we've lost that art. So let's look back at what's happened in that period. Two major trends are, to my mind, at the bottom of it. One is the rise of the post-industrial economy based on technology and service rather than on industry in an era of globalization. So we're all familiar with what that means, so familiar that we don't even necessarily think of it anymore as a very specific historical moment, but it is. And the second is the unwhitening of America. The Black freedom movement and mass immigration from the global South have brought people who don't look like the people Tocqueville wrote about in the 1830s to the forefront of political power, economic power, cultural power. Just when we need to extend more equality to more diverse kinds of people in America, inequality has widened because of these economic structural shifts. And social mobility, which used to be the promise of rising up, has declined, so that now America is less socially mobile than Europe, which was never true before. So we have a zero-sum fight for status and resources, which produces extremes of winners and losers. And everyone knows if they're a winner or a loser. It's always clear. Through most of the 20th century, the two parties represented two ideas. The Democrats were for the fair shake. The Republicans were for getting ahead. I'm really grossly reducing things, but I want it to be simple here. The fair shake and getting ahead. But starting in the 70s, those identities of the two parties began to disappear with the changing of the economy, deindustrialization, the decline of unions, the technology revolutions, the new era of globalization, the financialization of the economy. So instead of two ideas, I think we now have four. We are red and blue, we know that. We're divided into two countries, but red and blue America are in turn divided within themselves. So, two Americas, each one having two ideas about what America is or should be. So I want to go through each of those ideas to understand how our politics reached the point it's at today. The first is what I call free America. That's essentially the libertarian philosophy of Ronald Reagan, very powerful starting in the 1980s. The idea that if government would just get out of the way, individuals could pursue their talents and their interests, and freedom and prosperity would be widespread. Low taxes, deregulation. That became almost like the mantra, even like the cargo cult of the Republican Party. You hear it today. It's repeated endlessly. Low taxes, deregulation equals freedom and prosperity. Over the years, it proved not to be true, certainly not for a lot of people, but it remained the narrative of the Reaganite Republican Party, which is essentially the elite of the Republican Party. Second narrative I call smart America. That's the professional class. If free America appeals mostly to the business class, smart America is the professional class, educated elites who've entered professions that are on the cutting edge of the new era of technology and globalization, and who have become, you could say, the base of the Democratic Party. The party that was for the fair shake through most of the 20th century is really now the party of higher education and of professional success. That's who votes Democratic, people in the metropolitan areas with college degrees. Smart America seems like an almost unimpeachable idea. Meritocracy. If you're good, if you do the right things, if you get the right education, if you work hard, if you get good grades, you should have the fruits of success. The problem is, Smart America has become a kind of aristocracy in which families preserve those benefits for their children because, of course, the system is not entirely fair. They know the right people. They send their kids to the right schools. They read the right books to their children. Their children then marry people like themselves and stay within the group. And it becomes a kind of self-perpetuating aristocracy, so that even though they think of themselves as meritocrats who are there because they deserve to be there, it's very hard now to fight your way into it. Most meritocrats are now born into the meritocracy. And to me, that's almost the definition of a new aristocracy. So these two narratives, free and smart, elite narratives, one the elite of the Republican Party, the other of the Democratic Party, they welcomed globalization. They accepted American global dominance as a given. They produced a dynamic economy, a dynamic culture, but they also produced extremes of inequality, stratification. And they made huge mistakes. The post 9/11 years, Iraq, Afghanistan, the financial crisis of 2008, the Great Recession, all of these showed that the elites seemed either not to know what they were doing or not to really have the interests of other Americans at heart. They seem to be causing all the sacrifice to fall on the ordinary people while the elites kept making mistakes and getting away with it. So those years produced a lot of skepticism and even cynicism among, like, rural North Carolina or the Rust Belt. Americans began to think that the elites were in it for themselves. They lost faith in the institutions that the elites led: media, corporations, banks, even churches, and certainly government. That produced two new narratives. And the last two are, I think, rebellions. They're narratives that rebel against the optimistic promises of the first two. One is real America. It's a phrase that Sarah Palin used in the 2008 campaign. And she didn't say this, but what she meant was, I love being here in white Christian heartland America, where people don't have very good educations, but they dress like me and they talk like me, and we're all of the same tribe. She was the beginning of what you could call white identity politics, because she wasn't popular for her ideas. She was popular for her identity, even for the boots she wore and the music that accompanied her when she walked on stage at her rallies, redneck woman. It was identity. And real America is a narrative of an identity. It has lost faith in a lot of the promises of free America. Tax cuts, deregulation, business dominance, these are not the animating ideas of real America. And in a way, real America is a kind of rebellion of the body against the mind of the Republican Party, against the elite ideas of the Republican Party, which is why Donald Trump, for whom Palin was a kind of John the Baptist figure, Donald Trump didn't say, I'm going to cut your benefits. He said, I'm going to keep your benefits. He sounded more like a European populist. And in a way, real America brings us closer to Europe, because it's about blood and soil and identity as the basis for national identity. It's a nationalism that's exclusive and that isn't based in liberal democratic ideas. In other words, a Berlusconi, an Orban, a Putin. is a more familiar figure to Americans now because we've had Trump, we've had our own. So real America essentially divides us into the white Christian, hardworking, real people, and the non-real people. Who are they? Me, for example. People who live in cities, people with educations, people who work with their brains instead of their hands, Black people, non-white immigrants, them, the people who don't deserve to have all the power that they have, who pushed the real Americans out of line. The fourth is what I call just America, and it's also a rebellion. It's also an expression of cynicism against the promises of the boomers. It's a generational rebellion on the left. It's really within families almost. It's millennials against their parents. It's young, educated, but disillusioned Americans who think that the idea that we are becoming a more perfect union, that we are the leader of the free world, that no one, that you shouldn't see color, that everyone is an individual and has to be respected as such, that all that's a bunch of bullshit. And that in fact, America is profoundly corrupt, based in oppression, founded on slavery, white supremacist until the present, up till now, that we've never escaped our history, and that fundamentally you are your identity group, your views, your experiences, what makes you a complex, unique individual, that all gets pushed aside because what you really are is a member of an identity group, and that group is either in the position of an oppressor or of the oppressed. Wokeness is the crude term for this, but I don't use it because I think it's become too contemptuous and dismissive. There's a lot to be said for all four of these narratives. They have their value. They have their insights. They are correctives. Just America is a corrective for the shallow and complacent optimism of the modern capitalist America that doesn't want to look at our history and that thinks we've left all that behind when, of course, we haven't. But the problem is Just America answers with this monolithic and even illiberal view that says you are your group. And your group determines what you can say and what you can't say, what you can read and what you can't read, what you can be, and who has a right to power, to prominence. So the individual is sort of dissolved in the solvent of the group. And that, to me, is an illiberal idea, and it leads to illiberal things like suppression of speech, which is also called cancel culture. So real and just America are these rebellions in response to the failures of the elites, but they have led to this illiberal politics, which we now live with every day, and which has no ability to hear the other side, take it in, find some common ground, find some common truth, and then argue on that basis. Instead, it's existential, it's good against evil. There can be no truck with the other side because the other side is evil and has to be destroyed. And that's the way our elections have become. Each side sees the other as an existential threat. So the result of all this is that not only are we polarized and divided both between and within red and blue America, we've lost the art of self-government that Tocqueville wrote about. Look at our media, which is now dominated by opinion and Twitter and people simply saying the first thing that comes to mind and really by a desire to destroy the person on the other side. And look at our politicians and how they exploit the endless culture wars in order to advance their own careers. Walter Lippmann wrote, "Men will do almost anything but govern themselves. They don't want the responsibility." I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. We think of self-government as something we all want. In fact, it's sometimes just too damn hard. So instead, we give the responsibility to the experts, to a strong man, a demagogue, an algorithm. And this loss of self-government has a lot to do, I think, with the hidden code of equality. Any way to a more hopeful future has to address both of these things. It has to restore the art of self-government, and it has to create conditions of greater equality. And that leads to what I think of as a more hopeful narrative, which is how my book ends, the fifth narrative, which I call Equal America. And I think Joe Biden's agenda coming into office essentially was Equal America. His policy ideas were about giving the bottom 60% more opportunity, more of a chance to rise, more economic power through labor unions, through the creation of jobs for people without college degrees. The infrastructure bill is largely about that. Through breaking up monopolies, or at least regulating them, through restoring the social safety net, essentially reducing all the power that's accumulated in the top 10%, not 1%, 10%, professional class, the business class, and shifting some of that power and opportunity to the bottom 60%. Because even though we'd never expect equal outcomes, when conditions are as unequal as they are today in America, there is no social equality. We're not equal citizens any longer. And then the art of self-government, that's more subtle. That's more about how we teach our kids, the kind of media we want and create, the language we use, about civil society just as much as about politics and government, how we think, how we feel, how we talk, how we see one another as fellow citizens. And I just want to end with the notion that today our politics is marked almost overwhelmingly, so much we don't even identify it, by contempt. It runs through our culture and discourse like a toxic agent and corrodes everything. And it's a very attractive feeling, contempt. It relieves you of the burden of having to take seriously anything that the other person says, because they're despicable. So why should you? And it gives you a kind of moral superiority on the cheap. Very nice. It feels good. And then others want to join you in your moral superiority, and that creates the Twitter mob. Contempt, I think, is hostile to the spirit of a democracy of equals. It destroys that passion for equality that Tocqueville wrote about. In 1938, Thomas Mann, fleeing Nazi Germany, arrived in the United States and gave a coast-to-coast lecture tour on the coming victory of democracy. Imagine that, the coming victory of democracy. And he wrote, "We must define democracy as that form of government and of society which is inspired above every other with the feeling and consciousness of the dignity of man." That's Thomas Mann's definition of democracy. If you talk this way today, the chances are you'll be met with a lot of contempt. You might get ratioed on Twitter. And even Thomas Mann worried that he sounded a bit ridiculous. After all, this was the age of concentration camps and show trials. But he went on, "And yet it is a fact, more true today than ever, that we cannot allow ourselves, because of so much all too well-founded skepticism, to despise humanity. Despite so much ridiculous depravity, we cannot forget the great and the honorable in man, which manifests themselves as art and science, as passion for truth, creation of beauty, and the idea of justice." That's a very high standard, but Mann is saying this is what democracy demands, that we believe and act as if we believe in the dignity of man. So Thomas Mann came from the old world to the new and called American democracy to its better self in order to stop the spread of totalitarianism and war. And today, the call has come to us again, this time from Ukraine. Ukrainian resistance to Russia's aggression should remind us of what's at stake. of the half-forgotten values in our own democratic struggle, of why the fervid and tremendous idea is as fragile as it is precious, of how much we stand to lose if we allow the enemies of democracy, including the ones inside our own heads, to triumph. Okay, that's it.
But that wasn't it, of course, as the British-American entrepreneur Andrew Keane joined George Packer on stage for a talk about the rise of class in American society and why there's no socialism in America.
There's an eternal question, why is there no socialism in America? Books by very brilliant people have been written about it. I think it's because we do not have a feudal past. There's socialism in Europe because there was a feudal past in Europe that had to be, in a sense, eradicated. And even though it's never fully eradicated, socialism was the way Europe saw the way out of its own class system that was so locked and so stratified and hardened. Whereas in America, there's always been at least the idea that equality means nothing is barred to you. There is no door you cannot enter. You are as good as anyone, regardless of your name, regardless of where you come from. And so we don't need socialism. We have opportunity. We have democratic opportunity. Of course, there's a lot of faults and falsehoods in that statement, but it has been one of the dominant narratives in America from the beginning. Just as feudalism was for Europe, socialism is for Europe, and what we have is the ability of the individual to move up. That is no longer true, as I said in my talk. We now have a stratified society where you are going to die essentially where you're born, more and more likely. And that's why a lot of younger people, including people in the narrative that I call Just America, are talking about socialism. It's now on the table. In that sense, we've also become more like Europe. We have a right-wing populist and we have some socialists as well. So we've drifted toward Europe.
The idea of equality is a spiritual idea, isn't it? But what is it rooted in? Is it rooted in humanity? Or the ideal of equality? Because it's not a quantifiable equality, as you say. It's not everyone having the same amount of money or living in the same home, or even necessarily having the same opportunity. But it's rooted in the external manifestation of the self, or at least that's what you're suggesting in the book, is that for Americans to be Americans, they've got to appear equal to each other.
Yeah, I think you just described it really well. It's a sense of, it may have some abstract foundation in the rights of man, 18th century idea of the rights of man, but I think really it's much earthier and more rooted in one's mind and feelings, which is, if I look you in the eye, you cannot look down on me as lesser, and I cannot look down on you. Again, it's violated all the time, but that is the spirit. And I have a chapter in the book in which I talk about what makes Americans Americans. There's lots of qualities. Why is road rage a thing in America? Why are we so breezy with waiters? Why are waiters so breezy with us? Hello, my name is Justin, and I'll be taking care of you tonight. I don't hear that in Europe, but I hear it in America. What is that? Why do we smile so much? Why are we on a first-name basis immediately? Because of equality. All of those things come back to the sense that we are equal, and if you act as if we're not, if you disrespect me, you've sort of obliterated me, which is why I have to shoot you because you cut me off in traffic. So it's at the heart of a lot of our traits. And in a way, I want us to come back to some idea of what makes us all Americans, because we are so divided and so unlike each other. We no longer eat the same food, watch the same TV, get our news from the same place. We're in living in different realities, and yet I feel there's still some tendons and ligaments
connecting us. And I think they go back to that original feeling that we're equals, which just must come from the, not so much the Anglo culture, but the democratic origins of the country. The fact that Americans, what they all agreed on was democracy.
Yeah, I remember when I first came to America, I came originally from England. I was amazed, it was during the O.J. Simpson thing, and I was amazed that a man who was so wealthy and powerful would eat a McDonald's, which, of course, the O.J. Simpson scandal revealed. You argue in the book that Americans can't understand complex social hierarchy. Does that mean that the Americans of the 2020s are living a lie? So the wealthy dress as if they're poor, the poor dress as if they're wealthy. Everyone appears to be something that they're not. America is a giant stage, but no one's acknowledging the fictitious nature of the enterprise.
That's a very good insight. I think when Americans find themselves in older cultures where there's all kinds of unwritten rules of behavior, who sits down first? Do you ask for seconds? Do you accept seconds? When do you say thank you? When do you not? We're just completely clueless because our culture is a simple one. It is the culture of equality. It is not a culture of complex social relations in which people occupy different positions. But I think today, I know immediately who's had a college education and who hasn't. I know immediately who watches Downton Abbey and who doesn't. I know immediately who listens to NPR and who listens to AM talk radio. We are becoming a class society and a very stratified and distinct one, but as you say, we don't want to acknowledge it. So Mark Zuckerberg, you know, wears jeans with holes in the knees because that is a way of sort of bowing to the American God of equality. And yet we are living a lie, exactly, because we have become a class society, not a very complicated one, because it doesn't go back hundreds of years. But there is a revulsion, I'll be really honest, a revulsion among professional educated people for the way uneducated, working class, and maybe poor people live. And so they want to keep their kids out of that. They look down and see broken families, people who eat fast food at dinner, who don't read to their children, who have drug problems, multiple generations on welfare, father in jail. This is a white problem, by the way. It's become increasingly a white problem. And they think, God forbid, keep me out of that. And that is class revulsion. I think it's a new thing. And I think it's something that should really trouble the winners in our society.
I mean, Europeans thought about this a lot, de Tocqueville and Montesquieu in particular, and they argued that probably the healthiest democracies have their roots, for better or worse, in feudalism. Is this crisis of America, a crisis of democracy in America, is that underlining that Tocquevillian analysis?
I don't know. I mean, hasn't America been a kind of magnetic, attractive model for countries around the world until recently for a very long time and a source of imitation and emulation? Yes, we are more violent. Yes, we have more poverty because we don't have socialism. Yes, we have roads that are broken and trains that run slowly. In many ways, Europe is way ahead of America in just sort of having figured out modern life. And yet, people keep coming to America. And why is that? It's because I think that sense of dynamism and of there's a place for me. It's open. It's an open door. And I can make it there with my own abilities. They'll give me that chance. Again, less and less true, but the myth outlasts the reality, and I think it's still pretty strong.
George, you've got these four Americas: smart America, real America, free America, and just America. Just America is all about race. People often talk about slavery, perhaps slavery with the appropriation of the indigenous people's land as the original sin of America. But fitting it into your analysis of Americans never understanding complex social hierarchy and always being troubled by the external, race is doubly complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, Ralph Ellison once wrote that the position of the Negro, as he said, is at the core of the moral question of America, because it is the question of whether equality is possible. So there's always a question hanging over America about equality, because it's been violated and denied so long and so brutally. My answer is the passion for equality has driven the reform movements of the 19th and 20th centuries, just as much as the denial of equality has made equality a lie in our history. In other words, would there be a civil rights movement if there weren't a sense that all that history was a lie? Because I have been told that I am equal. Martin Luther King used the words of the founders all the time because it was the promise. It was like a check, he said, and it came back marked insufficient funds, but the check had been written. So it doesn't mean equality is meaningless. It just means the more it's denied, the stronger the passion and the drive to make it real. And I think something like that is happening today with Just America. I think the idea of social justice, which animates so many young people, is a critique of the failures of America to produce true equality. And in that sense, it's calling us to a reckoning that we've always tried to avoid. It's very painful, especially for white Americans. But then when it insists that we are all defined in essence by that identity and that history, that nothing changes, and that we are nothing but that essence, it runs into all kinds of problems. And I'll just cite one. Politically, if identity politics is accurate, Black and brown Americans would never vote for Donald Trump because he says the things that are so contemptuous and so corrosive. And yet, between 2016 and 2020, his vote in those two groups went up. Inexplicable to progressives, absolutely inexplicable, and yet true. So you have to get beyond the orthodoxy and ask yourself, why? How did that happen? What does that mean? And maybe what's limited about my view, my orthodoxy, and how should I change it?
And I mean, one of the things I think that America is being forced to grow up with is recognizing that just as there's the Black middle class, there's a white underclass, and this is a very painful learning experience for a country that took it for granted that white people were wealthy and Black people were enslaved. But let's go back, though, to the...
And there's also tremendous amounts of people who really don't think of themselves as either or are both or are a mix, because our rates of intermarriage have skyrocketed in the last 20 years, which is why it's odd that we are just now locking ourselves into identity categories that are so rigid, when in fact we become a far more fluid society than we've ever been.
So, George, you come up with these four Americas, which I think make a lot of sense: smart, real, just, and free. Beginning of American history, as everyone knows, it was a big debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, those who believed that men were angels, who were the Anti-Federalists, and the Federalists, like Madison, who argued that we weren't angels and we had to create a system of government to protect us from factions which were inevitable and unavoidable. Why aren't... I can see that these four Americas, two of them kind of fit into the modern Republican Party, two fit into the modern Democratic Party. But why are they so bad? Why aren't they just post-industrial version of factions? Every other country in the world has these four pieces.
They just behave badly. I mean...
Americans always behave bad.
Yes.
That's the nature of things. Even you acknowledge that in the book.
But have we ever... had a president who refused to accept the results of an election? No.
But what's that got to do with the four Americas?
Because real America sees itself as under continuous threat from just America, wokeness, and smart America, professional, elite, liberals. And that threat is so easy to activate, so easy to inspire in the voters who vote for Trump, that when Trump says, I was robbed, it was a fraud, they're going to believe him. When people march on the Capitol, invade it, and trash it, and Trump says, so what? These are good Americans. They're going to believe him. In other words, factionalism, which Madison warned against.
He warned against it. He just said, this is the nature of man, that you form into factions, and we need to create a government that will protect against the domination of a single.
But I think he also believed that elites, the leaders, would find a way to govern well, even if they belong to different factions. They would come together in the Senate and the House. They would pass laws. They would vote down laws. The president would sign laws. He would veto laws. But they would act with some degree of public-spiritedness. Otherwise, then democracy is a failure. And that's what we're facing. Elites who are so irresponsible, who have so little sense that there is a public good, a common good that they have some responsibility for. Trump is the most extreme example, but we see it every day, that then we see that democracy actually can't be protected from itself, even by someone as smart as James Madison.
Could one argue, George, that America works in every sphere except politics? So that smart America, real America, just America, free America, they all kind of respect and understand each other. It's just in this political sphere, certainly when it comes to economics, the American economy remains the motor of the world. Now, people have been forecasting civil war in America for generations. There's still very little, in my view, there's very little evidence of it being imminent. Might it be that America's politics, if not its democracy, that America is a democracy in everything except politics?
Except, has there ever been a period, other than maybe the late 19th century, when essentially nothing happened? No problems were solved. Year after year went by when there were large majorities who wanted climate change legislation, immigration reform, some kind of economic legislation that would give more opportunity, that wanted all kinds of changes, and it never happened. And the reason it doesn't happen is because all of those important checks and balances that Madison put into the Constitution required, as I said, a degree of public-spiritedness on the part of our politicians. And now the way you get ahead as a politician is by being the opposite of that, by having your own brand that whips up loyalty and fervor on the part of your tribe. And the more you are willing to cooperate with the other side, the more your tribe is going to see you as one of them and throw you out. The incentives are all against the productive work of government. You could say that's always been the case, but has it really? The Civil Rights Act was voted by a majority of Democrats and a lot of Republicans. Some Democrats who were Southern Dixiecrats voted against it. Some conservative Republicans voted against it. Every major piece of legislation in the post-war period up until the 70s had bipartisan support. And a lot got done. We had an EPA. We had a Clean Water Act. We had a Voting Rights Act. We had government aid to education. We had Medicare. All of these things have made concrete differences in people's lives. None of them is possible today. Why? It's complicated, but I don't accept the idea that this is the eternal truth of our politics. I just look back and see counterexamples.
You do look back, and that's the last best hope. In addition to Tocqueville, The Heroes That Come Out is a wonderful book, by the way. Any of you haven't read it, I know it's available both in Dutch and English at the front. Are you going to be signing?
Yeah, absolutely.
So no excuses. You've got to got to allow a poor author like George to feed himself. The characters that come out of this book, who are the heroes and the people you want to return to, and I mean that in, perhaps with a degree of criticism, is Horace Greeley, the quintessential journalist of the 19th century, anti-slave journalist. Frances Perkins, the first, that was a minister of labor.
First female cabinet member.
First female cabinet minister, the symbol and spirit of FDR's New Deal. And Rustin.
Byard Rustin.
Byron Rustin, who is a centrist African-American activist who was close for periods to Martin Luther King and represented a kind of unwoke approach to race. But my question, George, is aren't we going back? I mean, I still sense or sniff a nostalgia for the New Deal. But ultimately...
Guilty as charged.
Ultimately, you can only imagine going backwards and not forwards.
I'm not smart about policy and visions of alternative futures. I'm just not that kind of writer. I observe, I interview, I write about people, I write about what I see, I describe conditions, and I love history. So I have to leave it to the Thomas Friedmans and others to...
Thomas Friedman.
I guess he's a bit passé, but that's sort of his...
A bit. How many times has he been here?
No, there's a kind of writer who's useful, who imagines new ways of doing things. I'm not that writer. I do have a bunch of suggestions at the end of the book, but they're not original, and they're not the best part of the book.
But you shouldn't say that, because I mean, it's a wonderful book, and even this criticism isn't... I'm in your camp. Is ultimately you list a number of things that need to change to reestablish equality in America. So you need to repair the safety net, union rights, radical changes in tax laws, profound educational reform, and anti-monopoly legislation, all of which, you know, I've written books on the same stuff. But ultimately, you're coming across as a figure within
as
the progressive...
As a 20th century liberal, basically.
Well, you're coming across as a mix of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. So don't we need, in the new America of the 2020s, a new progressivism? Because you are a progressive, you're not going to deny that. But don't progressives need to figure out something that isn't just a return to the New Deal?
You know, I don't like the word progressive because to me it suggests a kind of orthodoxy about cultural issues and language and education and race that I'm unorthodox about those things. I get into trouble with readers of The Atlantic and The New Yorker when I write about those things. But I am, in a sense, an old-fashioned liberal because, for me, the New Deal was the Holy Grail, and it created a more equal America for several generations. So, Daniel Bell once called himself a socialist in economics, a liberal in politics, and a conservative in culture. That's about as close to a self-definition as I can give. None of those is forward-looking. They all refer to categories and ideas that we've inherited. So I don't... Do you have a radical new economic and political vision for how we can create more equality and get out of the traps, the culture war traps that we're in today? I'd love to hear it.
Well, I haven't read Last Best Hope. I mean, I think technology has to be part of the solution, for better or worse. I mean, we can't just... We had an argument over dinner about whether or not one of the people at dinner suggested that Elon Musk was no different from Putin or Bolsonaro, which I think is wrong. Certainly, and you've done a lot of work here. That's how we first met. The unwinding focused on Silicon Valley and technological disruption, innovation on America. There has to be a technological route out of it. And it's perhaps no coincidence that we're speaking on the very day that the one last civilized political figure in the world was reelected, and he's a technocrat, an unashamed technocrat. So maybe the fix is technocracy.
Well, Macron won by default. I mean, a lot of French voters stayed home. In the first round, if you added the votes of the extreme left and right, he would have gotten killed. Once he's up against a kind of has-been populist, yeah, he won. I don't think it was an endorsement of technocracy by the majority of the French people. I think there's tremendous dissatisfaction with the way the 21st century economy of high tech and financialization and globalization has left the middle class throughout the West. That's an obvious thing. And I don't know that anyone has the solution to that, but it's a glaring problem. I guess my question is, how do we have democracy with a technology that is almost inherently dehumanizing? Social media, for example, it was supposed to connect us to each other. It seems to have the effect of making us into avatars or caricatures of ourselves so that we can't really see each other as fellow human beings. And that leads to all kinds of problems. How do we use the technology we have to rehumanize our discourse so that we can do what Tocqueville thought had to happen face to face, which is talk, listen, debate, reason, decide? I don't have an answer, but to me, that's a big question.
I want to thank George for a wonderful conversation.
That was the British-American entrepreneur and writer Andrew Keen there, ending that conversation with George Packer, the author of The Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. Did you know that you can go to our website, john-adams.nl/videos, where there's a link to the video of this amazing event? We also have a newsletter you can sign up for and a treasure trove of great American thinkers and speakers at john-adams.nl. And while you're there, why not become a member of the John Adams? Not only do you support what we do here at the podcast, you get a discount to future live events. In the meantime, you should go to wherever you get your podcasts and leave a review of this show. It'll get the word out, and we can keep on sharing the very best of American thinkers with you, free of charge. That's it for this week's show. Our theme song is called La Prensa by the Parlandos. Our editor is Tracy Metz. From Amsterdam, this was Bright Minds, the podcast from the John Adams Institute. I'm Jonathan Gruber. Thank you for listening.